Chapter 8. Little had changed in Perturabo's command chamber since the Imperial fists had boarded the Iron Blood. Its rivet-stamped beams arched up to a cross-latticed vault hung with empty bird cages, and the thrum of powerful machinery echoed in the depths of the walls. Dusty banners and tattered maps of old Earth were hung with strips of oath paper recording victories no one beyond this room could name, and of which no remembrancer had ever taken note. The door would never be closed again, and the bloodstains on the wall had dried to a sticky brown. A broken console on one wall still spat sparks whenever current surged through the local circuits. Only the fragmented corpses of the Imperial fists had been removed, tossed from an airlock in the wake of the engagement at Fal, like so much waste. Perturabo's throne of cold iron, crafted from the molten remains of his adopted father's treasury, stood empty at the far end of the chamber beneath high lancet windows of latticed armour glass that looked out onto the ruddy sphere of Hydra Cordatus. Reflected light from the system's sun bathed the chamber in a cold, sepulchral light, and glittering points moved against the starfields, exposing the lie that they were stars themselves. A vast fleet of ships orbited at high anchor, the bulk of two legions jostling for space. But Forex paid the sight no mind. His entire attention was focused on Perturabo, who stood staring at the fleet as it prepared to break orbit. The order to withdraw from the planet's surface had come swiftly, and he had broken down the circumvallation works in a matter of hours. Bulk lifters and siege train workhorses had hauled the shaped ironworks and prefabricated elements back to the Legion freight ships, leaving the once fertile valley an irradiated wasteland of churned earth, bare rock, and iron-rich dust. Specialized bulk haulers had dismantled the Cavia Ferrum in darkness and transported its component parts back to the Iron Blood under a shroud of secrecy. Barban Falk had once again made his boast that he would return and build here, but Forex ignored his ingratiating words. Yet even as the last ship had climbed into orbit, Forex had a powerful sense that perhaps Falk might not be the only one returning to this world. With the siege works removed, the fleet had assumed position ready to depart orbit, a graceful ballet of efficiency that cared not for which master it fought. The Primarch stood on a raised dais, upon which sat his blood-stained throne, with the Legion's senior warsmiths arranged before him in precise ranks, nearly 200 warriors of superlative skill and genius. There at the front was Toramino, still eager to impress despite his earlier humiliation. Several of his fellow Storbizashk warsmiths gathered around in a show of solidarity, and Forex again felt the stirrings of some vague unease at the sight of Toramino's white hair and cold eyes. Perturabo stepped forwards to the edge of the dais.
"We are done with this world. Its fortress is dust, and its defenders ash."
No cheer greeted Perturabo's words, for he did not court the passions of his warriors, only their understanding.
"We join our forces with that of the Third Legion, our mission to break open a Xenos fortress and obtain weapons of such power that we will no longer need to take the metal to the stone. Win this war, and our days of breaking Earth will be over. We will be warriors again."
Before Perturabo could continue, Toramino spoke up. "My lord, do we now take our orders from the Phoenician?" Forex held his breath and awaited violence, but Perturabo shook his head.
"No, Toramino, we do not. Brother Fulgrim presented me with an opportunity to wipe away our failure to destroy the Imperial fists at Fal, and I chose to take it. In the absence of orders from the Warmaster, we will seize the initiative and become stronger than ever before."
Perturabo shifted his focus from Toramino and said,
"That is all. Return to your grand battalions."
The warsmith snapped to attention, hundreds of booted feet slamming down in unison as they turned and marched from Perturabo's chambers. Toramino and his cohorts were the last to leave, and Forex watched them go with a mixture of trepidation and eagerness to achieve something worthwhile. With the warsmiths gone, Perturabo turned and sat upon his throne, sitting back and letting the echoing silence of the chamber settle upon him. Forex, Kroger, and Falk moved to their allotted positions before the Primarch, each at the tip of a trident blade carved into the iron deck plate.
"Opinions?" asked Perturabo.
"I don't trust the Emperor's children," said Forex.
"Diplomatic," said Perturabo. "But I can be more honest. I don't trust Fulgrim."
"My lord," said Kroger, "then why are we going along with this scheme?"
Perturabo sighed.
"Because we have no choice."
Barb and Falk spoke up.
"We always have a choice, my lord. We are not slaves to the whims of the Phoenicians, questionable honour."
"Once I would have killed you for a remark like that, Falk," said Perturabo. "Now I think you are being too lenient on my brother."
"Then why do we trust him?" asked Forex.
"We don't," answered Perturabo, leaning forwards to rest his chin on his steepled fingers. "I don't know what lies in the Star Maelstrom, whether it's some dead Eldar god, a stockpile of weapons, or something else entirely, but there's something valuable there. That's for sure."
"How can you know that?" said Kroger.
"Because my brother knows the best lies are the ones with a measure of truth at their heart," said Perturabo. "And if there are weapons there, I think Fulgrim intends to seize them for himself and claim the glory of their discovery as he presents them to the Warmaster."
"If he even hands them over," added Kroger.
Perturabo nodded.
"Now you're thinking like a Triarch."
Gathered from the scraps that had fought their way out of the killing ground of the Urgal Depression on Istvan V, the crew and command structure of the Sisypheum was ad hoc at best. It was an Iron Hand strike cruiser, but that distinction had meant nothing when the bloodied survivors of the massacre had staggered back through the firestorm of betrayal in search of escape. Iron Hands and their mortal serfs formed the bulk of the crew, for most legionaries attempted to reach their own craft, but warriors of the Salamanders and a single Raven Guard were counted among its number. In the wake of the slaughter, escape from the Istvan system had been a nerve-shredding series of mad dashes under fire and silent runs through the traitor blockade, culminating in a final sprint to the gravipause, the minimum safe distance between a star's mass and a vessel's ability to survive a warp jump. The Sisypheum had escaped the trap, but not without great cost. The months that followed saw the Sisypheum embark on a series of hit-and-run attacks on traitor forces on the northern frontiers of the galaxy, wreaking harm like a lone predator swimming in a dark ocean. Traitor forces seeking flanking routes through Segmentum Obscurus were their prey. Scout craft, cartography ships, slow-moving supply hulks heavily laden with mortal troops, ammunition and weapons. Disruption and harassment were their main objectives until contact had been established with fellow survivors. A series of coded astropathic blurts were detected on a shifting cycle of frequencies that matched up to numerical codes relating to the orbicular structure of a particular type of igneous rock found only on Medusa. Freighter Thermatica had decrypted the message, and contact was established with disparate groups of loyalist forces that had escaped the massacre, and a stratagem of sorts agreed upon. With the 10th Legion too scattered to function in a traditional battlefield role, its surviving commanders found their own way to fight back, as the thorns in the flanks of the Leviathan that distracted from the sword thrust to the vitals. Nykona Sharokin was one of the stragglers swept up by the Sisypheum, Atesh Tasa another. Neither was an Iron Hand, but such a distinction had become largely irrelevant in this arena of shadow war. Both had proven instrumental in allowing the Sisypheum to function and remind the traitors that the Emperor's loyal warriors were far from out of this fight. Around the moons of Ophiuchus they had ambushed a gaggle of bulk haulers, filling their cavernous holds with weapons looted from its polar manufactories. 10 ships had been crippled or punched into the gravitational clutches of the planet, and another 2 forced to flee with their hulls trailing fire, spilling their cargo into the void. When a squadron of Death Guard escorts had paused in their pursuit of an Imperial vessel to refuel, the Sisypheum had fallen upon them like a raptor at the hunt. With Sharokin's unparalleled knowledge of ambush tactics, they had caught the enemy ships at their most vulnerable and destroyed all 3, never knowing if the naval crew ever learned of their mysterious benefactors. At Cavor Sata, Wayland and Sharokin had captured an unlingual cipher host, one of the so-called Kryptos, a hybrid abomination creature of the Dark Mechanicum that had previously kept the enemy's code network, a cryptographic impossibility to break. With the Kryptos, Loyalist commanders could now access the traitor's coded communications. And with that knowledge, Captain Ulrich Branthon had ordered the Sisypheum to make the circuitous journey to Hydra Caudatus and a meeting of traitor primarchs. As Gilliman had once said of the 13th Legion, "If you must fight an ultramarine, pray you kill him. If he is still alive, then you are dead." The same could be said of the Iron Hands, and never more so than when they had suffered such inconceivable loss. If the Heresiarch Warmaster expected the 10th Legion to crumble and fall apart with the death of Ferus Manus, then it only went to show how fundamentally he had underestimated his brother's Legion. To allow grief, no matter its cause, to abrade the fighting heart of the Iron Hands would be to admit weakness into their ranks. If anything, the awesome, unimaginable scale of their pain had hardened their resolve and made them even more dangerous. They had turned grief into hatred. Ulrich Branthon was a revered captain of the Iron Hands, but Wayland always felt a great sadness each time he went to the chamber. Together with Nykona Sharokin, he made the approach to the captain's sealed quarters under the watchful gaze of 2 Morlock warriors. Septus Thoic and Ignatius Newman stood at the end of the wide corridor. Both were warriors who had seen the very worst the galaxy could throw at them and had spat back in its face. Fellow survivors of Istvan V, they had been amongst the very first Iron Hands to make planetfall, marching alongside the best and bravest of the 10th Legion. Like all those who had escaped the massacre, they had cut their warplate with the names of the fallen. But these warriors had a name acid-etched on their shoulder guards that marked them out as special, even in a brotherhood of remarkable warriors. They had seen Ferus Manus die. The lights were low, for power consumption was rigorously controlled by Cadmus Tyro, the de facto commander of the vessel in the increasingly extended times between Ulrich Branthon's moments of wakefulness. The black armor of the 2 Morlocks was inscribed with intricate scriptwork, each name inscribed over the cuts, tears, and burns inflicted on Istvan V. Like other veterans, they had refused to repaint or repair their armor until the traitor who had murdered their Primarch was dead. Thoic's face was bisected by a curling series of scars inflicted by a laughing swordsman of the Emperor's children, while Newman's features had the plasticized sheen of synth skin after a close-range plasma detonation had seared his battle helm to his skull. His flash-burned eyes had been replaced by simple targeting optics, but his hearing was almost entirely gone. Wayland nodded to the Morlocks.
"Iron Father," said Septus Thoic, "good to have you back aboard."
"It is good to be back," responded Wayland. Sharokin simply nodded.
"Did you see him?"
asked Ignatius Newman, too loudly, each word carefully enunciated. Wayland didn't need to ask who Newman meant.
"We did," said Wayland, turning to Sharokin.
"What did he look like?"
Wayland wished he could tell them that he had seen a monster, a creature of ultimate evil, but that would be a deception, and any Iron Hand would prefer the truth over glossed fiction. "He looks unchanged, my brothers," said Wayland, signing his answer for the virtually deafened Newman. "He is the Phoenician." Seeing their disappointment, he added, "But he is no longer handsome. Our Raven Guard brother shot him in the head."
"Did you kill him?" cried Newman.
"He fell," said Sharrikin. "I can say no more than that."
Septus Thoic at last looked directly at Sharrikin.
"You and I do not see eye to eye, Raven Guard, and we never will, but I thank you for that shot."
"Pay Septus no mind," said Ignatius Newman loudly, gripping Sharrikin's hand and shaking it hard enough to hurt. "Anyone that spills that bastard's blood is a brother of mine."
Sharrikin nodded his thanks, but kept silent.
"You'll be needing to speak to the captain," asked Thoic.
"Yes."
"The freighter and Captain Tyro are in there with Tarser."
"Apothecary Tarser," said Wayland. "He has a rank, and you will use it regardless of his legion. Is that understood?"
Morlocks were the veterans of the legion, but even they had to respect the word of an Iron Father. Both warriors nodded and made a fist of their iron left hands.
"Enter, Iron Father," said Thoic, placing his fist against the lock plate
and making a complex series of micro-movements with his fingertips. The cog-toothed mechanism securing the door hissed open, and a wave of cold, static-charged air washed over Wayland and Sharrikin. They passed through the door and into Captain Ulrich Branthon's cryonic sanctum, a place of sterile white and silver. A laboratory, a sepulchre, a shrine to mortality, and the defiance of time's passage all in one. The chamber was an insulated blast chiller, lined with machinery and floored with thermally shielded cabling, power sources and frost-limbed lights that cast their illumination in anti-senescence frequencies. Four figures filled the space, one standing apart with his arms folded across his broad chest, two working on the guts of a machine that even Wayland struggled to understand. And the fourth... The standing figure was Cadmus Tyro, a captain and former equerry to Captain Branthon. His hairless head was tanned walnut brown, one eye a cold green augmetic, the other an equally cold haze orb, and his half-mechanized, half-human face was pulled in a permanent grimace of ill temper. A golden-winged eagle, beyond the ken of the Mechanicum adepts who had studied it, perched on one shoulder, preening its glitter-sheen wings with its razored beak. The mechanized creature had been with Branthon since a foolhardy expedition into the Land of Shadows as a youth, but had since attached itself to Tyro, faithfully watching over its new master. Branthon called it Garuda, and it had gone into battle many times atop the war standards of the Iron Hands. The crew of the Sisypheum simply knew it as the Bird, and it had survived the Istvan massacre without so much as a scratch on its golden body. Some said its ancient technologies were beyond the reach of contemporary weapon tech to harm. Others that it was simply lucky. More desperate whispers even claimed it was a sign of the Emperor watching over the Legion in these troubled times. Freighter Thematica knelt with his four servo arms repairing a chugging coolant unit as a dozen probes simultaneously worked on multiple components at once. His red cloak was pulled to one side, and the heaviest of his mechanized servo arms turned a heavy fuel cylinder around, as if looking for a leak or other imperfection that was causing it to function at less than optimal efficiency. Thematica looked up briefly from his labour and gave Wayland a curt nod, a gesture of respect between Iron Fathers. Beside the freighter was a warrior in the muted jade of the salamanders, the ivory heraldry on his shoulder blurred by the accumulation of frost. Atesh Tarsa's black skin and coal-red eyes were in stark contrast to the monochromatic chamber, almost alien. Yet Wayland had found the salamander's apothecary to be among the most human of them all. It had already been decreed that, upon Tarsa's death, his name should be carved on an iron plaque and hurled into the magma-filled caldera of Mount Karashi. There it would become part of Medusa itself and the molten metal that flowed beneath its shifting lands.
No greater honour could be conferred upon a warrior not of the Legion, and Tarsa had accepted the accolade with quiet solemnity. It was an honour well deserved, for the care the salamander's apothecary had given the final occupant of the chamber had earned him the undying respect of every iron hand aboard. Encased in a silver casket, with a frosted canopy of ice-cold glass, lay Ulrak Branthon, captain of the 65th Company, iron-blooded son of the Niranka clan. His body was unmoving, shrouded in motionless streams of freezing vapour. Even through the white mist and frost-webbed glass, Wayland could see the mortal wounds done to Branthon. Both his legs were horribly mutilated, one little more than stringy sinews of ruptured meat and heat-fused bone, the other severed just above the knee. One arm was held to the body by a splintered nub of bone and tattered scraps of skin. His arm was missing much of its mechanical structure, and all but one of the fingers had been broken off in the flight from Istvan. Branthon's chest was a ruin of four bolter impact craters that ran in a ragged line from hip to sternum. Under anything approaching normal circumstances, the captain would have been accorded the honour of being interred in a dreadnought sarcophagus, but such an option was unavailable with their severely limited resources. Brother Bombastus had already demanded the Iron Fathers remove him from his sarcophagus, surrendering his own existence to allow the captain to live again as their only functional dreadnought. Branthon had graciously declined the offer, knowing that he would never be as fearsome as Karashi Bombastus, the Iron Thunder of Medusa. Clamped across the captain's torso, like a mechanized arachnid parasite, was a glittering device of coiled silver and bronze. Its central mass squatted on his chest, while its segmented appendages encircled his body. Monofilament wires extruded from its multiple limbs, wormed their way into the captain's flesh all across his torso, and though it looked painful, Wayland knew the heart of iron was all that was keeping Branthon alive. That and the stasis field generated within his casket. Tyro turned as Wayland and Sharokin entered, his grim face somehow managing to look grimmer than usual. The cyber eagle fixed whirring optics on them both, passing their biometric information to him in a series of binaric squawks.
"This had better be worth it, Sabic," the captain said.
"You know it is," answered Wayland. Tyro and the other senior officers had already heard the recording Wayland and Sharokin had made on Hydra Cordatus.
"It sounds like they're chasing blind superstition," said Tyro, "and I don't like basing a mission on the words of a traitor."
"You don't have to like it," said Wayland, tiring of Tyro's sniping. "That they believe it is enough, and if there's any substance to what the Phoenicians said, then do you want to risk being wrong? If those weapons exist, we can't risk Horus getting his hands on them."
"He doesn't have long, you know," sighed Tyro, as if Wayland hadn't spoken. "The heart's keeping him alive, but it's killing him too. We're taking a great risk in bringing him out like this, for all sorts of reasons."
"I know that, Cadmus," said Wayland, "but he needs to hear this."
"So you saw Fulgrim and Perturabo," boomed Thematica, finally standing from his work and sweeping his cloak back around him. "Shame you didn't kill them. I'm cooking up a little something that might have helped with that. A thermic displacement beamer. Deadly little thing. Works on the entropic quantum theory of all things existing at all times. If I can get it to work properly, you could swap elements in the heart of a star with a corresponding element of a person. I imagine that would ruin anyone's day, even a Primarch's."
"Sharokin took a shot at Fulgrim," said Wayland.
"Did he now?" said Thematica, with an appreciative grunt. "Didn't kill him, though, I expect."
"I don't know," said Sharokin. "We had to leave in a hurry."
"Aye, we're aware of that," snapped Tyro. "The Sisypheum had to make dozens of manoeuvres to avoid detection by the traitor fleet, and you don't need to tell me how much fuel that cost us."
"You're right," agreed Wayland. "I don't need that. So we should get started."
Tyro conceded the point and nodded to Thematica and Atesh Tarsa.
"How long?"
Apothecary Tarsa consulted a data slate and said,
I would not recommend removing the stasis field for more than a minute. Captain Branthon's life is limited, even with the Heart of Iron attached.
It's supposed to heal him, but you say it's killing him, said Sharrikin.
I understand little of what it is doing to him, confessed Tarsa, his voice cultured and precise. It appears to be attempting to regrow some of his major organs, but with each iteration of renewal, his vitals go down across the board. If we were to let time take its course, the captain would be dead before it had repaired him enough to live.
None of us truly understand its workings, said Thematica. It's old tech, one of the few pieces left intact after Old Night, much like Branthon's eagle there. The Primarch himself found it during one of his travels into the Land of Shadows. Thematica laughed warily. Said one of the ghost clansmen gave it to him while he hunted the great silver worm.
Enough, said Tyra. We don't need another history lesson, Freeta.
Ah, youth, said Thematica, addressing Sharrikin and unimpressed by Tyra's brusqueness. They forget that history is the great constant of our species. So much changes, yet so much, sadly, remains the same.
Freeta, said Tarsa, we're ready. Brothers Sharrikin and Wayland, are you ready?
Wayland nodded and unclipped the Vox Thief from his belt. He plugged the trailing copper wires running from its internal memory coil into a pair of sockets on the side of Captain Branthon's casket.
I've compressed the Vox recording into a data blurt, he said. Everything we heard will be transferred to Captain Branthon in less than a second. Give the word when his cortical functions are high enough for cognition.
Tarsa bent to the console controlling the cryo-suspension as Thematica busied himself with the stasis field. Both men faced each other like mortuary attendants.
Raising internal temperatures, said Tarsa. 0.5 degrees to 1.5 on a 10-second gradient.
Disengaging stasis field in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Mark.
A digital chronometer began counting down the seconds as the mirage-like shimmer enveloping the Medicaid casket flickered out of existence. A wave of cold spread from it, freezing air kept at bay by a tiny bubble of time taken out of the universe. Wayland alternated his glances between Branthon's hollowed-out face and the readouts on the monitors. Slow arcing waves were growing in amplitude as brain activity magnified with the steadily increasing temperature. Branthon's eyelids flickered, and the blood oozing from his many wounds flowed sluggishly onto the absorbent mat upon which he lay. The Heart of Iron tightened its grip on his chest, its serpentine arms constricting around his body as though seeking to crush him. More of the monofilament hairs whipped from its glistening limbs and pushed through his hard skin to the organs below. The captain's head arched back, and a tortured breath escaped him, as though the pain that had been kept at bay renewed its attack with interest. The eagle let out a plaintive squawk at the captain's renewed signs of life.
Now,
said Tarsa, and Wayland pressed the transmit button on the Vox Thief. There was no outward sign that anything had changed, but the panel on the front of the device indicated that the data had been successfully transmitted. All they could do now was wait. The seconds ticked by, and Wayland watched the count reach 30. The captain's breath came in short, pain-filled hikes, the flow of blood from his ruined body becoming steadier as his body thawed. Each revivification was taking longer to rouse the captain from his deep hibernation, and it was only a matter of time before he would simply slip away rather than awaken.
"It's not working," said Cadmus Tyro. "Shut it down."
"Give it time," said Thematica. "Brain activity is increasing."
"Temperature at optimal levels," said Tarsa, modulating the admixture of stimulants and Laramon coagulants being pumped into the captain's bloodstream.
"I said shut it down," ordered Tyro. "He'll be dead before he reaches consciousness."
"We have time," said Thematica.
"No, you don't. Re-engage stasis. Now."
"No."
"Ulrak,"
said Cadmus Tyro, and Waylon saw the equerry's bitter countenance soften at the sound of his friend's voice. Even artificially rendered through the casket's augmenters, there was no mistaking the power and authority of the Iron Hands captain. Garuda flapped its metallic wings and perched on the edge of the casket, cawing in welcome. Branthan's eyes opened, and Waylon's heart went out to this wounded brother as he saw the sheer effort of will it was taking to maintain his composure in the face of such agony.
"Waylon's recording in loaded. No choice. We go after them. We stop them."
Blood flowed freely from Branthan's wounds. That he was still alive, let alone able to communicate and process information, was a miracle of endurance and fortitude.
"We don't even know if there's any truth to what they were talking about," said Tyro.
"Irrelevant. Something is there. The traitors want it, so we deny it to them."
"This is your order?"
"It is. Make it happen. Upon the anvil."
"And by the iron," finished Tyro, "it will be so."
"1 minute,"
said Tarsa, and a mist of cold air billowed around the casket.
"Re-engaging stasis field," said Thematica.
"Until the next time, brother."
Brantham's words were cut short as he was shut off from the passage of time by the shimmer haze of the stasis field. The captain's eagle loosed a cry of machine sorrow, and the silence that followed was that shared emptiness at a beloved's deathbed, leaving each of the Iron Hands wrapped in their own thoughts of mortality, grief, and anger.
"We have our orders," said Wayland, as much to break the silence as to say anything of use.
Cadmus Tyro nodded. Struggling to mask his emotions and setting his jaw, he exhaled deeply, and Wayland was reminded of the decades of friendship that bonded Tyro and Branthan. No easy thing to see a friend in torment. Worse if that torment was maintained by your own hand.
"A damned thing," said Thematica, placing an iron gauntlet on the frozen glass of the casket.
Wayland stepped towards the casket and placed his mechanized hand next to Thematica's.
"We'll see it done, my captain," he said.
Tyro nodded and placed his iron fist next to the silent mech eagle.
"Sleep, friend, and know peace while we shoulder your burden."
The moment passed, and, respects paid, the Iron Hands stepped away from their mortally wounded captain.
"The word is given," said Cadmus Tyro at last. "We need to keep ahead of the traitors if we're to stop them. Is that understood?"
"It will be done," assured Wayland.
"And when we get to the warp storm," asked Thematica, addressing Wayland, "can that guide of yours get us through it?"
"I believe so," said Wayland. "I don't like it," said Tyro. "I spent a lifetime fighting his kind. Can't trust them."
"He knows a way through," said Wayland, "a secret way known as the Paths Below." Once again, the Legion captains gathered in the Heliopolis. Fulgrim was to hold court, and word was that it would be rapturous. Wounded starlight from the churning warp storm beyond the system's edge fell in a column through the coffered dome of blood-splashed gold. Lucius had often wondered what secret debauches had taken place here to have splashed blood so high, and why he had not been part of them. He contented himself with the delicious images his imagination conjured to fill that lacuna. Reality would only disappoint, so where was the value in knowing the truth? Lucius's twin swords were sheathed at his narrow hips, one a blade Fulgrim had given him in the wake of Istvan, the other a fractal blade taken from the corpse of a Skitari suzerain on Prismatica. They were itching to be held, though Lucius told himself that was simply his need to match himself against an opponent of worth, something sadly lacking within his own legion. He'd hoped to goad one of the Iron Warriors into a challenge, but even the hulking brute with the temper had looked like poor sport. The The pale, bull-headed statues arranged around the walls were sticky with a fresh layer of death fluids. Blood trails arced in long teardrop sprays that spoke of severed arteries and great violence. The scorched banners were no less defaced, the reminders of the Legion's heritage virtually illegible now, and telling nothing of its former allegiance. Lucius wanted to rip them down, to burn them and dance in the flames. He circled Fulgrim's black throne upon its garish and vulgar plinth of broken stone, remembering a time when he had thought to test his blades against the Phoenician himself. The thought of how he had nearly fallen into the Primarch's trap gave him a delicious frisson that few things could in these bland days. His mouth went dry at the memory of watching the captains of the Legion in battle against Fulgrim in the Gallery of Swords aboard the Andronicus. They had believed Fulgrim to be something other than he appeared, and had captured him, intending to inflict the most sublime pain to drive out whatever had infested their Primarch's body. It had been a ruse, of course, the Phoenicians' perverse way of testing their devotion. Self-indulgent theatre to flaunt his power and reveal his true purpose to his devoted warriors. Those warriors were gathered around him, arranged without heed for old ranks or former position. All that now mattered to the Emperor's children was that sensation be indulged, that every experience be wrung dry of indulgent excess. The archaic terminology of rank was slowly becoming a thing of the past. Lucius regarded each one in turn, imagining them coming at him with weapons unsheathed, and picturing how he might dispatch each one with a single blow. Julius Caesarum circled in opposition to him. The favoured son, as he was now known, avoided his gaze with a fixedness that made Lucius smile. His face was cut with fresh recasting, moulding his features into a nightmarish pastiche of humanity, a mask of flesh transfigured beyond all sanity by bone grafts, horn implants and ocular components that had reshaped his eyes into two wide orbs of utter blackness. Marius Verosian and his cacophony basked in the shrieking discordia blaring from the ceiling-mounted voxcasters. The screams of Istvan V had been replaced with the music composed by Bekwa Kinska for her great Madaviglia, suitably amplified, distorted, and reworked by the Primarch himself. Its shrieking cadence was a rare note of stimulation, and Lucius paused a moment to listen to the jagged spikes of music that jangled and tore at his senses. Its violence was diverting, but the armoured bodies of the cacophony jerked and danced like the marionettes of a demented puppeteer, their bizarre sonic weaponry crackling and throbbing as they absorbed the potency of the diabolical sounds. Chrysander of the Blades stood immobile, his pouting expression hardened at having been summoned from his chamber of terror and flesh-brutalizing. His hooked tongue licked cracked lips, putting Lucius in mind of a basking lizard too far from water. The daggers thrust through the flesh-sheaths of his bare chest and thighs made him look like some pre-unity techno-barbarian warlord, an impression only enhanced by the cloak of razor thorns tearing at his back. The hooks and rings piercing the face of Kalimos were linked by taut chains that would prick and tear the flesh in new and exotic ways with each word he spoke. Idly, Lucius wondered which words would cause Kalimos the most pain, and resolved never to say anything that would give him cause to voice them. To deny Kalimos his desired pain gave Lucius a moment of pleasure. But it vanished a heartbeat later, as ephemeral and fleeting as most such petty amusements. Lanomia Ruin and Bastanaya Branks stood together, the latter having transferred his blood affections from the dead Heliton to the Venom Master. Ruin's armour was festooned with daggers and razor spikes, each coated in one of his many amusingly lethal toxins. Branx wore his twin swords in imitation of Lucius, and the idea that his skill with a blade was even close to matching his was laughable. The scar Lucius had given him as a reminder of that fact was now hidden beneath a tattoo. Fulgrim swept into the Heliopolis with a fanfare of shrieking slaves crawling before him, a roiling carpet of flesh to be crushed underfoot by the Primarch's titanic strides. They pulled and clawed at one another to feel the Primarch's killing weight upon them as it snapped their bones and pulped their organs, each skeletal slave howling in pleasure as it died. Fabius trailed in the Primarch's wake, his monstrous chirurgeon clicking and snapping like a living thing, and his appearance made Lucius want to kill something. Two hooded figures marched on either side of the apothecary. One Lucius recognized as the Eldar guide, but his interest was piqued at the sight of the second. He had the bulk of a legionary, but moved with the shuffling gait of a sleepwalker or a cripple. "My sons," said Fulgrim, ascending to his throne with a single bound and leaving his hooded companions at the foot of its rubble plinth. "Everything I desire is within our grasp. We are a step closer to realizing my dream of the City of Mirrors and seeing the reflection of the Angel Exterminatus looking back at us." Clad in armour of gold and purple, Fulgrim wore his long white hair braided into painful-looking cornrows, and a single scalp lock with a silver blade woven into its end. A patchwork pelisse of draconic scale, torn from the bodies of dead salamanders, hung from his left shoulder, while a quilt of midnight black feathers draped his right. A mosaic of ivory chips that had once been the iconography upon the armour of Ferus Manus formed an eagle upon the Primarch's breastplate, one with both heads sagging upon broken necks. "Perturabo has aligned his legion with us, and his warriors will storm the gates of hell to bring about the apotheosis whispered of in the farthest corners of the warp," said Fulgrim, and his warriors cheered themselves hoarse in adoration. Fulgrim basked in their devotion, feeding on their love with an indulgent smile that did not include them. The Primarch lifted his hands to his head, placing his fingertips just below the marks on his temple, one an entry wound, the other a scar where Fabius had dug the needle from his skull. "Though my brother's help was not won without cost," said Fulgrim with a winning smile, "I had to allow our enemies to shoot me in the head to secure it. Ah, with such unsubtle wiles do we ensnare the foolish and the naive." The Emperor's children roared. Yet Lucius felt himself curiously detached from the cheering, as though Fulgrim's plans were an irrelevance. "And when Perturabo realizes you have lied to him, what then?" Lucius searched for the source of the voice, and was shocked to find it was his own. The words had sprung unbidden from his throat, and the thrilling surge of blood around his body was like a powerful burst of adrenaline straight to the heart. He heard a savage intake of breath from the legion warriors around him, and resisted the urge to draw his swords. It felt as though the words had been placed in his skull and burst forth of their own volition. "Lucius," purred Fulgrim, "always the spiteful remark and the barb that steals my thunder." "My lord," said Lucius, "I don't know, and I had such high hopes for you," said Fulgrim, descending the rubble slopes of the plinth. Lucius had already seen that to draw blades against Fulgrim would be to die, but the urge to bear his steel was almost irresistible.
"I don't know where those words came from, my lord," said Lucius.
"Hush, Lucius, it's all right, I know," said Fulgrim.
"You do?"
"There is nothing I do not know of my legion, Lucius. Remember that, always. To forget is to risk grave consequences. Isn't that right, Eidolon?" At first Lucius thought he'd misheard. He couldn't have heard the name his Primarch had just said. Fulgrim must have bestowed the late Lord Commander's name upon another.
"Behold, the Risen One!"
cried Fulgrim, pulling back the hood of the robed figure who had entered with Fabius. A collective gasp of astonishment swept around the Heliopolis at the sight of the warped features, the stretched-out jaw, and the face of a warrior thought dead at the hands of the Primarch himself. Lord Commander Eidolon threw off his robes, revealing his armoured form, gleaming and painted in neon colours that offended the eye. Barbs of coiled wire trailed scraps of Hessian from his shoulder guards, and his mighty hammer was slung in a looping series of bandolier straps that buckled in a slash of leather across his chest. A raw suture ran the circumference of his neck in a perfectly even line. His skin was the colour of faded parchment, his eyes black and glassy, dead like a doll's. He limped towards Lucius, a lipless grin splitting his already too wide mouth. Lucius felt his skin crawl at the sight of a dead man walking, repulsed and exhilarated at the same time.
"Surprised to see me, swordsman?" gurgled Eidolon.
"I saw you die," he replied. "I drank wine mixed with your blood and spinal fluid."
"And yet I live,"
Lucius laughed.
"That is life. You can barely walk, and if I drew my sword, I'd cut you down before you get that stupidly big hammer free."
"I need no hammer to kill the likes of you," said Eidolon. "The things I can do now..."
Even before the last word was out of Eidolon's mouth, Lucius had both swords drawn and the blades resting crossed on either side of the Lord Commander's gorget.
"I'll cut that head off for good this time," said Lucius.
"Hush, my son," said Fulgrim, clearly enjoying this reunion of old enemies. "Eidolon yet lives because I desire it so. He has a part to play in ensuring the City of Mirrors is built to my exacting specifications. Now, lower your blades." Lucius nodded and spun his swords, ramming them back into their thigh sheaths. Fabius stepped forwards and said,
"Thanks to my ministrations, the Lord Commander's body will regain its former strength and more in time. Pray I might do the same for you one day, swordsman."
Lucius laughed in the apothecary's face.
"Save your breath, Fabius. No one's going to kill me, not in this lifetime or any other. They wouldn't dare."
"They will," said Fulgrim with a knowing wink. "One day they will. But like Eidolon, you will rise again, my beloved son, though your rebirth will be somewhat more enjoyable, I think, for you, at least." Emboldened by his continued survival and Fulgrim's cryptic words of a future beyond this moment, Lucius ignored Eidolon's baleful stare and said,
"Then I ask again, my lord, what happens when Perturabo finds out you have lied to him?"
Fulgrim moved to stand in the centre of the Heliopolis until his body was limned by the poisonous light of the warp storm's grotesque eye. He spread his arms wide, the draconic scale and raven feathers billowing around him like two almighty wings in a sourceless wind.
"By the time my dull brother realizes the truth, it will be too late for him," said Fulgrim, in the sickly light that sloughed from him like a serpent's skin.
"The Morgitter Stone will have done its work, and I will have what I want, and the Angel Exterminatus will arise from the flames of his death."